quit.
Afternoon. We'll call this meeting of the State Government Veterans Budget Division to order. It's Tuesday, April 2nd, 2013, about a little after 3 o'clock. Welcome back, everybody, from Easter Passover break. And a quorum is present. Today, we're going to hear six bills. It's my intention to lay them all over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. We had a late scratch with Senator Sparks, who did he get sunburned or what was his problem? I don't know. Anyway, we'll be hearing that bill Thursday. And so we're going to start, and I know he's here, with Senator Lapps, Senate File 158. Senator Lapps, good to see you, and start your presentation anytime.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. I appreciate your hearing the bill. Senate File 158 would provide for the creation and installation of a bust of Nellie Stone Johnson in the State Capitol building. Nellie Stone Johnson was a real community mover and changer for many decades in Minneapolis and throughout the state. I'll give you a little bit of information about her background, and I bring something of a personal history as well, because my grandfather, Reuben Latz, who was a labor leader in Minnesota, helped teach Nellie Stone Johnson the ways of politics, and Nellie mentored my father, who was a former legislator, and I had the opportunity, like so many others, to sit in Nellie's office, her shop, where she repaired ties and shirts, and talk about all sorts of things. Really a remarkable woman who grew up in greater Minnesota on a farm. She, back in 1925, got her GED from the University of Minnesota. She was a union organizer and a seamstress. She was born in Dakota County in Minnesota. Over the years, did some remarkable things. She was inspired the Fair Employment Practices Act in Minnesota, Practices Department, spearheading the effort to create that first one ever in the country. I don't know where Clover Township is exactly, but she attended school in Clover Township, Minnesota. She lived in Minneapolis. She was an African-American woman who was one of the few who grew up on a farm in Minnesota and, of course, had to fight for all the rights that she had. She helped to organize the hotel and restaurant workers' union over the years, was active in the civil rights movement and the NAACP. She was on the Minneapolis Library Board for 4 years. And was on the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities Board of Trustees as well. Of note, she was a WCCO good neighbor also. This is a woman who cut a wide swath across a whole variety of populations in Minnesota, a real trailblazer. When she was hired as an elevator attendant at the all-male Minneapolis Athletic Club, they wanted to cut her wages from $15 per week to $12.50 per week. And that inspired her to resist that, if you can imagine even the thought of those wages. Now, that was in 1924, fair enough, but still it was a substantial cut. Also of note, in 1950, she authored an initiative from the Minneapolis NAACP that led to the desegregation of the United States Armed Forces. So quite a history. I'm just perusing some information to make sure I give you the significant pieces here. She was a State Department emissary traveling to Africa with then-Vice President Walter Mondale. And Governor Rudy Perpich had appointed her to the Minnesota State University Board. So I have with me, who can testify in support of or give information, some representatives from the State Historical Society, and including the person who manages the State Capitol here for their interior spaces, and also some other folks who knew Nellie and be advocates on her behalf as well. At the policy committee, I also had with me the Commissioner of Human Rights who supported this bill. The fiscal note is $30,000. That would cover the cost of the creation of the bust itself for $15,000, $10,000 for the pedestal, $5,000 for some additional preparation relating to that. Nellie would be, I think, the first African-American woman to have a representation in the Capitol, an artistic representation in the Capitol in terms of a bust. And I think the testimony at the last hearing was that there is another woman who's in a painting, I think, in the Capitol. Is that right, David? Two other women are in paintings, no busts. Pardon me?
Plaques.
Oh, plaques. Okay. So a lot of white males here in the Capitol. But Nellie was a trailblazer in so many ways, in addition to her color, that it's hard to pigeonhole her in that respect. I'd ask for your support.
Thank you, Senator Latz. Did you want anybody else to testify? Anybody else want to testify?
Well, we're certainly happy to answer
questions. I think you did pretty good. Oh, that's fine.
Did you want to add something, sir?
Yeah, somebody want to add something?
Why don't you both come on up?
Thank you.
Each state your name for the record and go ahead and give us your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Frank Vigiano. I'm the former executive director of the Minnesota State University Student Association, and I was involved in creating the Nellie Stone Johnson Scholarship, which was spearheaded by former Chancellor Carruthers and President of the State University Board, Rod Searle, and former Speaker of the House, who was very good friends with Nellie, despite their party differences. But I just want to say on behalf of working for the students all these years, I'm treasurer of the scholarship now. We just had a dinner last week. We raised $40,000. Last year we gave out over $25,000 in scholarships to disadvantaged students with labor backgrounds who attend MNSCU institutions around the state. This is our 26th year as a scholarship. But if I could, in a capsule, say what Nellie was. Nellie was a person. I met her when she was in her early 80s, and she was just beginning her higher ed career on the State University Board. And she was very instrumental in helping to get students to vote in their college communities. We worked with her and then with the legislature so that the universities would give their lists of students to the county registers so it would be easier for the students to be able to register to vote. She was very interested in getting young people involved in the process, and I think a lot of the voting patterns we see now in discussions are a result of some of the stuff Nellie did. But I went to the creation of the Nellie Stone Johnson School in Minneapolis, and I remember the four big things that they congratulated her on was, and she was still alive then, was on voting rights, women's rights, and minority rights, and helping the average person to be able to access the system. And she was a very good person, and until the day she died, she was always advocating on behalf of disadvantaged people, and one of the reasons why I was so attracted to her. But I hope you'll support this. Thank you.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Louise Sundin, and I think the hat I appropriately would wear today would be both as MNSCU trustee and also friend of Nellie a little bit before Frank Neuer, back when she was a part of the labor movement. But this woman had so many firsts that we won't try to list them all. Senator gave you a good a quick view of her past. But if you can imagine, she started at age 13 with her political activities, dropping leaflets to farmers on her way to school at 5 o'clock in the morning that her father had put her up to. So she was organizing farmers at age 13, and that activity lasted until her last weeks. She imbued this incredible energy, and she demanded attention, and she demanded that you do something with your life, and that you do something with your knowledge and your education. It was so important to her. And if you think of the fact that when she supported and worked for Hubert Humphrey back when he became mayor of Minneapolis, she was the one that was putting a lot of the human rights ideas in his head that ended up in that speech that was so important to this country in the Congress. So from that time until she organized young women at the athletic club who were being sexually abused by a supervisor, to organizing and being on the national board of the hotel restaurant workers, to being involved and being so many firsts in the city of Minneapolis. We're thrilled that we can be a part of advocating for one piece of a memory. She now has a book written about her. There was the play at the History Center, and we have the scholarship that we support each year for the last 26 years. But we also think it's appropriate for all those young children that walk through this building, so many thousands of them every year, that they also will see this bust and ask, who was Nellie Stone Johnson? And there will be people to tell them. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you, Ms. Sumner. Any additional testimony?
Mr. Chairman, I'll just add one little tidbit here to reflect Nellie's background. She wasn't only African-American, according to Wikipedia, which we all know is the most reliable source of biographical information on the web. She was African-American, German, French, Seminole, Irish, and Cherokee. So a very diverse background, which...
Melting pot.
A melting pot in and of herself, and it reflected the kind of diverse interests and background that she had across agricultural Minnesota as well as the urban core.
Thanks for the questions. Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Latz, do you know, Ms. Summon mentioned something about Nellie Johnson taking up for women's abuse at the athletic club. Do you know what the result of the case of that happened as far as the gentleman supposedly that was bringing abuse against these women? Was he tried, or was he, do you know if there was a successful case that came out of that situation for Ms. John, for Nellie Stone?
Sundin tells me that he was fired.
That's all?
This was, she worked at the Minneapolis Athletic Club in 1924, and for some years after that. So back in those days, they didn't have a Human Rights Act. They didn't have a Federal Civil Rights Act. They didn't have a Fair Employment Practices Act. There were very few, if any, remedies available under the law.
Thank you.
It was an act of courage and bravery just to challenge what was going on.
Other questions? If not, Senator Latz, we will lay over Senate File 158 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you for your
thanks
consideration.
Thanks for your time. Appreciate it. Senator Gazulka, Senate File 341. We've got a handout that's coming around. Go ahead, Senator Gazulka.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Senator Gazulka here. This is Senate File 341. It's a request for continued funding for the Minnesota Military Museum. Mr. Chair, if I can now, I think I'd like to make that author's amendment to change $100,000 to $170,000.
So we have a amendment by Senator Gazelka on Senate File 341.
Mr. Chair, line 1.6, first numbers 100,000, changed to 170,000. I'll explain the reason why.
What line is that?
I can do it now or after, okay. Whichever.
Well, that's I think it's fine. It's on line 1.6, section 1, and it's 100. We're going to change 100,000 to 170.
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
All right. On the amendment to Senate File 341 to change 100,000 to 170,000, is there any discussion on the from the committee? Not all in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? As amended.
Thank you,
Senate
Mr. Chair.
Senate File 341. Go ahead, Senator Gazelka.
Members, the Minnesota Military Museum has been receiving an appropriation from the state since 1978. The reason why I wanted to increase the funding, which is presently $90,000, the prior 2010-2011 was $100,000, 2008 through 2009 was $100,000. But the reason why I want to increase the funding for the Minnesota Museum to $170,000 is they would like to be able to support a half-time archivist position. This position is needed to deal with the large volume of paper records, photographs, documents, maps, and other archival records we have been asked, or they've been asked to store and maintain for the Minnesota National Guard, Camp Ripley, and various armed reserve units. But beyond that, I think what I'm going to do, Mr. Chair, members, is ask Executive Director Jeff Thielen to make his comments, and he's on my right. Jack Johnson is on my left, and we'll go from there.
Mr. Thielen, if
thank you
would identify yourself and go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Jeff Thielen. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Military Museum at Camp Ripley. And I did hand out, everybody has a copy now of our promotional rack card and brochure that gives a little background in the history on Camp Ripley, or on the Military Museum at Camp Ripley. The biggest misconception that's out there right now is that the museum is a part of Camp Ripley. And that hurts us in a number of ways. We are a 501c3 nonprofit organization. this pass-through grant that goes through the Historical Society that we've received since 1978 is roughly 19% of our operating budget. We are open 7 days a week starting May 1st, including all holidays. We average between 15,000 and 20,000 visitors every year. And we're one of the highlights. We're one of the main tourist attractions to Camp Ripley. Other than if you haven't been there, and maybe I could if show of hands of the members of the committee that have been to the museum. If you haven't been there, we'd gladly give you a tour anytime you want to come up. So we'd love to give you a tour. We have this in our operating budget. We have a very our budget is approximately $250,000 a year, and all of our staff are half time, or we've got some of the best volunteers in the world because we have an awful lot of veterans that are giving back in ways that that only veterans can give back and great volunteers can give back. We probably have 20 volunteers that are coming in. Some are coming in 1 or 2 days a week working on various projects for the curator. But we have a great staff of volunteers. The one thing that we haven't been able to touch and the reason for the increase in this appropriation is we have an archival a building that's full of archives, and I call it our black hole because we maintain the military records for the Minnesota National Guard of the units that have been deployed to various places in the country and throughout the world, different who commanded units, rosters of units. This past summer, we received 40 boxes from the Adjutant General's office, and we have no staff to deal with them. The records from Afghanistan, Minnesota Guard involvement in Afghanistan and Iraq are currently at the Adjutant General's office now, and I believe that those records will be coming to us shortly. With me today, I've got Mr. Jack Johnson, who's a member of our board and 12 years ago was the curator at the museum and put in He was also the command historian for the Minnesota National Guard in years. And some of the records that we received last summer were records that he put together when he was command historian. So it's something that's lacking. We get calls on a daily and weekly basis from interested individuals and states who are looking for information. And the only thing we can tell them is we'll help you as we can with volunteer support or with support from the curator. But the organization isn't there. So my thoughts were that the best thing we can do, we currently now all of our staff is only part-time. And to fit with that, if we were funded, we could hire a half-time archivist that could at least put together a plan to organize the records that we do have in the archives. And as I said, these are records for the Minnesota Army National Guard. We do have some records for Army Reserve units in the state, and we have an awful lot of Camp Ripley records that have been just turned over to us. We just don't have the manpower to take care of it. So that's basically the story. And I don't know if Jack wants to add anything from his days as historian with the Guard or...
Mr. Johnson?
Jack Johnson is mentioned, a longtime member of the board and former curator. We have an enormous amount of material in these archives, and I want to emphasize that the increase that we're asking for here, that additional amount, is going to be focused on helping us to manage that. We've been using a retired volunteer, an old Marine Corps guy, in fact, has been our archivist for about the last 15 years, but he has some health issues. He's no longer able to do it. He used to be able to come up one day a week and help, and he can't do it anymore. And it takes some professional expertise. We're being buried, and we need help, and this, I think, is the only way we're going to be able to get it. So I would urge your thoughtful consideration of this need.
We appreciate the testimony. Senator Gazalka, is it okay if we lay this bill over for possible inclusion?
Mr. Chair,
File 341 will be laid over for possible inclusion. Thank you all for your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Third bill is Senate File 1055, Senator Peterson. Senator Peterson, we're going to go from military archivists to barbers.
Got that right. Walking in this room, Senator Saxog, and seeing this committee, I'm glad to see that you signed on to this bill, actually. So, members.
All right. It was good to have you here. Senate File 1055.
Members, what we have before you today is a bill that has been around for a little bit. We first talked about it last session, and as I mentioned earlier, I'm grateful for Senator Saxog's support in terms of signing on to this bill. If you had a chance to review the fiscal note there, you'll see that this bill represents kind of the first significant change or updates relating specifically to the barbers. These are the men and women that cut people's hair in terms of so it's a housekeeping, a bill that's much very much housekeeping in nature. And this bill specifically relates to their licensing fees, creating some penalties, and appropriating money for the regulation and for this this board that handles the enforcement of these regulations. The most controversial part of the bill that you may have heard about in the past really relates specifically to Section 17, if you have a copy of the bill in front of you, which is the very last page, and if you've heard about this bill in the past, it basically asks that if you are not a licensed barber in Minnesota, we do not want you to display a barber pole. That's the red, white, and blue barber pole. For some reason, this issue has been very controversial in the past. Our office and the work we've done on this, we don't believe that it is. It's very quite simple. If you're a licensed barber, you can display the pole. If you're not, you ought to not give the impression that you are a barber, and that's really the goal of the bill, along with the other details We do have a representative from the Barber Board here as well to answer any questions that you might have.
I'm assuming that the Executive Secretary Thora Fisco is here?
I am, yes.
Yeah, we look forward to some of your testimony.
Thank you.
Go ahead. Identify yourself first for the record.
I'm Thora Fisco. I'm the Executive Secretary for the Minnesota Board of Barber Examiners, and I believe that Senator Peterson did a nice job of representing the bill before you. The thing that I would add is when you look at the face sheet of your of the fiscal note, it would appear that we're asking for an additional $29,000 from the general fund. Actually, the board collects more revenue than we're allocated now. Excuse me. Currently, our projections for this year are that we would generate $312,000 in revenue, and we're currently allocated $257,000. And so basically, we're asking to be allocated the funds that we collect. And, of course, any funds not expended will return to the general fund. So,
and very good.
I'm here for questions, if anyone has questions.
Any questions from the committee?
Mr. Chair.
Senator.
Senator Peterson, can you tell me, does the Barbers Association support these changes?
Yes.
Thank you.
Senator Peterson. Yeah.
Yep. Okay. Yeah, Mr. Chair and members, these changes have essentially come from the industry. If you're like me, you know, we did spend a fair amount of time double-checking with the barbers in my district, and I did not have any opposition from the barbers that I talked to in the district I serve. So.
Senator Gazalka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Peterson, can the barber downstairs support this
bill?
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Senator Gazalka, you know, he's not been with us this year, but last session he was with us and was following this bill closely. So I think I would have to ask Thora if his position has changed on that.
Ms. Fisco.
Mr. Chair, Senators, yes, and Ken the Barber is actually a board member now, and yes, he is in support of these changes. Thank you.
Other questions? Yes, Senator Stumpf.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In Section 4, where you change from two additional months to 300 hours, how do those equate in barbering? Are they comparable, or is that something that is 300 hours longer or shorter than 2 months?
Ms. Fisco.
Mr. Chair, Senator, it's actually the change from 2 months to 300 hours is a clarification because our rules require 300 hours. And so they're seen as the same thing. And so we're just trying to make it some consistency.
Other questions? Any other testimony? If not, Senator Peterson, we're going to lay over Senate File 1055, possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yes, thank you both.
Thank you.
Next, we have Senator Johnson, Senate File 770. Welcome, Senator.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and members, Senate File 770 has been brought to me by the Board of Cosmetologists asking for some continuing education for the people who work in that industry. And I have with me Jim Hurst today, who's representing them.
Mr. Hurst, if you want to identify yourself, go ahead and testify. That'd be great.
Very well. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. For the record, my name is Jim Hurst. I'm here today on behalf of the Minnesota Salon and Spa Professional Association, representing cosmetologists in the state of Minnesota. And I want to thank Senator Johnson and her co-authors for bringing this bill forward. Basically, what this bill does is it sets out as a condition for renewing one's cosmetologist license the requirement that they must take 3 hours of continuing education pertaining specifically to health, safety, and sanitation, as well as 1 hour of continuing education specific to Minnesota state law and rule pertaining to cosmetology. Unlike other states, Minnesota does not require a continuing education requirement in this regard. And the only exception would be instructors of cosmetology. They are required to do 45 hours per license period of continuing education. This only calls for 4 hours. The term of a individual's license is 3 years, so this breaks down to just slightly over 1 hour per year. It's not a burden to cosmetologists. It's not a burden to the State Board of Cosmetology. As a matter of fact, the State Board embraces this approach and this manner of educating cosmetologists. It's very important because, quite honestly, without this, there have been many cases of public health hazards regarding some of the chemicals and the implements that cosmetologists, estheticians, and nail technicians use in their day-to-day practice. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I would stand for any questions that you or the committee may have.
And I was just going to ask one question. Is there schools set up to give this type of continuing education?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That is correct. Currently, schools currently offer the continuing education component for instructors. So this is not a problem for schools. As a matter of fact, in your packet, you do have one letter from a school supporting this as well.
Senator Gazalka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the testifier, is there any opposition among cosmetologists or chains of places that do hair?
Mr. Hurst.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Gazalka, no, there's no known opposition, and we have been meeting with salons and schools and cosmetologists over the past 2 years, and we've received overwhelming support for this approach.
Senator Gazalka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you know what percentage of people that would fit under this category are franchises or, you know, or for example, Regis or whatever? I mean, as far as the total overall?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Gazalka, I do not have that information. I'd be more than happy to research this more and get back to you. It certainly runs the gamut from certainly the chain operators that you mentioned to the individual practitioner as well. So, but I will see what I can do and get back to you.
Senator Gazalka.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. My only thought is I'm in an industry that also requires a continuing education, and it actually seems more of a hassle than it's what it's worth. And I just wondered if in your industry there was a lot of ongoing training anyway, but maybe not. And I'm certainly not against you wanting to do this in your industry. I'm just a word of caution about continuing education. It can grow to a place that nobody really wants it.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, and Senator Gazalka, you make a very good point. I do know that there are a number of chains that do some aspect of continuing education. However, that's mainly focused on new trends, new styles. We don't think it's appropriate to mandate continuing education specific to those areas. That's up to the individual themselves if they want to better their professionalism in that regard. But what we want to focus on is the health, safety, sanitation aspect, because not only is it good for the industry, but bottom line is it's good for the Minnesota citizen and consumer out there.
Thank you.
Question, Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the testifier, you have on page 2, says here, if the board determines that a licensee has failed to provide proof of necessary credits earned during the specified time, the board may revoke the individual's license. Are there examples where the board, I mean, right now, they can't do anything, and this would give them the wherewithal to this kind of determination to say this has to be done or you won't stay in business? I mean, are there examples of that?
Mr. Hurst.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Anderson, last year the State Board, incidentally, the State Board has only 3 inspectors going around across the state. They found hundreds of violations, but they found, I believe it was 122 that rose to the level of corrective action, which can include cease and desist orders. The reason the language is permissive in the bill is to ensure that there wasn't some misunderstanding or something. We wanted the board to have the flexibility to either penalize or perhaps in the initial stages suggest to the individual that go get your continuing education, come back and show us the proof, and we're all fine and dandy. Now, I'm not saying that in a few years that perhaps we revisit this and make it so that there is definitely a penalty, but this would take effect August 1st of next year, 2014, which would give the industry enough time to get the message out to licensees. The state board has also agreed to be very proactive in informing licensees should this become law. And so that's why at this point we're making it permissive on the board's behalf as to what action to take.
Thank you.
Senator Gazalka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I got more time. So to the testifier, if you or do you allow online training, would that be an option that people would be able to? I'm thinking about Senator Stump's area, and if they got to drive somewhere, that'd be crazy. So is that something that would be available the way it's worded now?
Mr. Hurst.
Yes, Mr. Chairman and Senator Gazelka, I would point you to line 2.6 through 2.8, which specifically says that it can be offered as an online or as an independent study option, because some individuals, not to pick on Senator Stumpf because I'm originally from that part of the state as well, but should individuals not want to be technically adept at using computers and everything, they could at least seek out an independent study option as well.
Thank you.
Senator Stumpf.
Oh, no.
just a curious thank you, Mr. Chairman. Curious question. If somebody, you can go through a cosmetology school, I assume, mm-hmm. and once you graduate, let's say you do not get your license right away, you get sidetracked, or the person gets sidetracked for a period of time, what do they have to do to get back into getting their license? Do they have to go back through the school, or is there kind of an upgrade period? Or
Mr. Hurst.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Stumpf, that's a very good question. It's my understanding that once you complete your schooling, you then set yourself up for the state exam. Now, I suppose there could be situations where once you've done all that schooling and you've succeeded with your curriculum at the school, that there might be a situation where there is a time delay in taking the state exam. I'm not aware of any issues whereby someone has taken the schooling, then has waited a couple years before taking the exam, nor am I aware of any requirement that you must take the state exam within a certain time frame after graduating school. Certainly the continuing education is tied to renewal, so I would have to say that 99.9% of the time, once the student completes their schooling, it's just an automatic. Usually the school sets up the schedule for them to take the state exam, and then they're licensed. And the continuing education is based on renewals, so newly licensed individuals would not need to take continuing education to get their initial license, because it's assumed that their schooling has taken care of that.
Senator Stumpf?
Chairman and my colleagues here, in the previous bill for relating to barbers, there was a provision that said that if they went through the school and then they didn't take their or pass their or receive their certificate, that they had to go back and take 500 hours of a study course, which, it seems like it's a long time, but I don't know if that means that 500 hours, it says a course of study of at least 500 hours. That may mean an apprenticeship of 500 hours, or it may mean some kind of a further study program. I'm not suggesting. I wanted to just point that out, that there's a
consistency.
So, Mr. Chairman, if I may, to that point very, very briefly, it may very well be an apprenticeship program. I know barbers do have such a program. There is nothing comparable with cosmetologists as far as an apprenticeship program. And if I may also, in regards to the previous bill that was heard, I'd like to go on record that cosmetologists have never been opposed to the section whereby their bill proposes that a barber pole only be placed in front of a barber shop. We've never disagreed with them in that. So just want to make that point as well.
Other questions? Other testimony? If not, thank you, Senator Johnson and Mr. Hurst. We're going to lay over Senate File 770 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Next, we have Senate File 1226, Senator Stumpf. Senator Stumpf, Senate File 1226.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Senate File 1226 relates to public TV, and in Greater Minnesota, we enjoy public TV probably more than, well, I think they enjoy it across the state, metro as well as rural areas. And in one part of our area up in northern Minnesota, it actually is kind of the main TV that people watch for news and weather and sports and everything, and that's Lakeland out of Bemidji, and they cover a big territory. Public TV is a kind of, it has a lot of the same expenses that other private stations have, but they have been trying to maintain their facilities, their capital investments, and keep their programming up. And a lot of other states have gone down the road of putting more into more public money dollars into their public television in their states. And there is one piece of information that's in your packet that's quite interesting. It has this bar chart, you'd call it a bar chart, but it shows some of the states in the Midwest. Minnesota, without the legacy funding, was very near to the bottom. Well, it was the bottom, and then with the legacy funding, it has come up. But if you look at the funding per capita that, like, say, North Dakota, Montana, and especially like Wisconsin, Iowa, South Dakota, and Nebraska, they have a significant more public dollars that go into their support their public TV stations. My wife Carol has found some programs that I absolutely thoroughly enjoy, and maybe many of you have watched them too. Doc Martin was one of the programs that was on public TV. It's a whole series of compilations of programs that were put together, and it's very, very good television, clean. Another one was the Downton Abbey series, which is a lot of people watch, and so it's something that people really enjoy. So anyway, the bill is very simple, but it's asking for an increase of some funding for our public TV system in the state of Minnesota. And Mr. Straczynski is here. He asked me if I would get down on my knees and start crying and begging, but I said, no, I can't do that.
That's my job.
So are you turning it over? Are you handing it off to Mr. Straczynski?
I am.
All right.
I am.
Well, we're going to start out.
We're starting right off.
Senator Stumpf with a question.
I think he just visited the barber shop too.
We've got Senator Chamberlain with a question.
Mr. Chair, I can wait until Mr. Straczynski's finished.
Okay, very good.
Thank you.
Go ahead, Mr. Straczynski. Identify yourself, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, I'm Bill Straczynski, and I'm here representing the Friends of Minnesota Public Television. I want to thank Senator Stumpf for bringing this bill forward, as well as Senator Metzen, who unfortunately is not here, and Senator Dietzick, Senator Gazelka, and Senator Dames for also co-authoring this important piece of legislation. And I also want to go on record, Mr. Chairman, that this operational grants program, which has been part of this budget since the 70s, is handled through the Department of Administration in their budget, and the Department of Administration has done a wonderful job, their staff, and as a fiduciary in managing the affairs of this grants, particular grants program. There's some work involved, but we've had a very successful, long-standing relationship with that department. Senator Stumpf did an excellent job, and I want you to know that since the time we presented originally in your committee, we did add, at the request of Senator Gazelka, the legacy appropriation that goes to public television. That's why you see the little green bar, the difference between this general operating funds and the legacy funding. And that's an important distinction, primarily because we appreciate deeply with the legacy funds, and I think you all kind of know what we do with those dollars, but we can't use any of those dollars for station operations. This money you give us here is our bread and butter. It's a significant and important part of our economic wherewithal for each station. And the differences here is public television and the relationship we have with this committee and with the state of Minnesota is that we're a partner with the state of Minnesota. Some of these states, public television is owned by government. And in 27 states, I believe. In Minnesota, we took the approach of cooperation and a partnership and a collaboration working together. It's less expensive for the state of Minnesota because we have six independent 501c3s. But the state dollars, I want to underscore that, though, that's extremely important because that's the dollars we get and we use very carefully. There's two other charts I just wanted to quickly mention that are also in the handouts. Chart number one is matching grants. This actually shows where we were in 1999 compared to where we are today. And that little blip upwards you see was a one-time appropriation that was available in 2008 session. They had some one-time money, and they gave it to public television. That's the way to blip up, but it was never part of the base. And so that just shows you where we were in 1999 to where we are here today in 2012. And the next chart I want to show is capital grants request. Also shows 1999 to where we are today in 2012 and how dramatically the funds have been reduced over the years. Now, we've taken our lumps along with everybody else, appropriately so, as state government was trying had a tightening of the budget, and we participated in those activities as well. But I think it's important that you understand that because we're asking for an increase of about $1.5 million in our grants program this year from where we were of last biennium. There's some important reasons for that. Now that you have a little bit of the background, why this is such a critical issue now. Last fall, NTIA, which is the National Telecommunications Information Agency, made a decision no longer funds equipment grants for public television. I think it's probably public broadcasting in general, but I know it's for public television. We used to take state dollars, and we did our digital conversion for $45 million. We would take state dollars and match those with federal dollars under equipment grants. And stations did it every year to maintain the integrity of their equipment and do upgrades. That program no longer exists at the federal level. So that puts a little bit more pressure on us as well. But, you know, if you ask the stations the impact of the cuts over the years, we draw six different responses from the stations. but there are several common themes I want to share with the committee. Maintenance of services in the face of the cuts has some made some current operations unsustainable in the long run at the current funding levels. Maintaining the integrity of the equipment, for example, is very difficult. Our equipment was just upgraded to make the digital conversion, but now some of that equipment's approaching 10 years old. It needs to be replaced, renovated, and repaired, and that's an important part of this money. Staff in public television is no different than a lot of other 501c3s. You got to love it to work in public television. Many of them have not had raises in all of the stations for several years. And I know, and I talked to the manager of the Bemidji Brainerd Public Television Station, Bill Sanford. He says that they've actually, for people who on the news programs, who do the news program, the nightly news program, their salaries are about $18,000 a year. You got to love it to work in public television for a full-time salary of that. I mean, and they do. But unfortunately, it's led to 7 of his 25 employees have changed last year. I mean, they have constant turnover, and that becomes a problem. Many stations, I think of the Appleton station, use state dollars to help their station operations, obviously, but they've had to go out and borrow money to help their cash flow in recent years. And when you borrow money, you have to pay that back to pay interest. So they're into the lines of credit for longer periods of time. As a specific impact of the cuts we've taken over the years. We're shifting to other resources. Stations have I also know that in a survey, many of the vehicles are old. They got 200,000 miles on them, for example. You hear this all the time, but those vehicles need to be replaced and what have you. They've also eliminated a lot of positions in the last decade, and some of that relates to outreach, education outreach, which we do in the communities. We try and do with our legacy fundings particularly. Ready to learn, encouragement programs, parent programs, those kinds of things, we can no longer do. We used to do those kinds of things. But it's important that we get back out and provide that kind of information and work with the community. Finally, I wanted to say, Mr. Chairman, as we reduce state dollars to public television, you're also reducing dollars from the federal government and other resources. All of our money is matched by the federal government. So as we took cuts here, it was compounded. So I encourage the committee to take a good look, see what the value you get for the dollar. 2.6 million people watch us each week. We deeply appreciate our ongoing strong relationship with the Minnesota legislature, and hopefully we'll continue to do good things. But we're to the point, we have no places else to cut, and it's becoming quite painful now, and would appreciate some restoration of these funds. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you, Mr. Stasinski. Questions? Additional comment from the anybody else in the room? All right. Thank you for your testimony, and we're going to lay Bill 1226 over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Members. Thank you. Lastly, Senate File 536, but not least.
Thank you.
Yeah. Senate File 536, Senator Chamberlain. Senator Chamberlain, Veterans Service Office Grant Program Modification Appropriation. I'll turn it over to you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Most exciting bill of the day.
Sure.
Certainly the most, well, not the most costly, the public broadcasting was just more costly than that. What you have in front of you, Mr. Chair and members, is what this bill does is it increases some funding and changes the structure of an existing program, Veteran Services Enhancement Program for County Veteran Services Offices. And a couple things about it. As you see in the description and overview of the bill, it used to be on a 3-year cycle that they did this funding. This bill changes to 1 year annually. The other thing it does is it bases the changes the funding a little bit. Gives them a base grant of $7,500 to each county, then based on their population, the veterans' population in that county, and it's prorated, and they get some more money based on the number of veterans in the county. And it also lays out clearly what those dollars could be used for. So with that brief overview, I'll introduce former Representative Mr. Kreisel, and I also have Mr. Schoen here.
Good to see you.
Go ahead, Mr. Kreisel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is John Kreisel. I'm currently the Director of Veterans Services for Anoka County. I'm here to testify in support of this bill. Previously, what we've done with this grant money in Anoka County is to help veterans get secondary exams to get them service-connected for mental illnesses that they could then be treated for by the VA. The VA does everything they can to support veterans and help them, but oftentimes with the backlog, they're not able to spend as much time evaluating veterans for post-traumatic stress or acquired mental illnesses from combat-related situations. And so in the process of trying to get them benefits and get them treatment for that, they'll be denied service connection for that. And what we've done previously in Anoka County, we've used grant money like this to send them to a private examiner that can sit down with them, actually take the time to diagnose their condition, and if they can indeed grant it service connection, say that that condition was related to their military service, then that would overturn the VA's decision and help them not only receive some financial compensation, but then really give them access to that mental treatment that they deserve, and that will help them be happy, healthy, productive citizens for the rest of their life. So that's just one of many things, many ways that this money can be used, but it's a very important piece of legislation, and I really hope that we can get this passed.
Questions for Mr. Kreisel? Senator Stump.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Kreisel, could you kind of explain the rotating three-year, and I'm either it went in one year and out the other, or I didn't. How does that work? How would that help? How does that work?
We're going to get some help from Mr. McElhaney.
Yeah, he's much more qualified to answer that question.
Great.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. My name is Mike McElhaney, Legislative Director for the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs. And to your question, Senator, there's two grants that we're trying to combine. And first, I want to preface this with this language is in Senate File 1184 right now, or 1154, the governor's budget bill. The provisions are the same. The dollar amount is different. The governor's dollar amount is less than what is in this current bill. But they do the same thing. And what they do is attempt to combine an operational grant and an enhancement grant into one statute and combine the uses and get rid of the three-year rotating cycle. The three-year rotating cycle was a $95,000 annual appropriation that we had that every year, a third of the counties would be able to put in a grant request to receive those dollars.
Okay.
Good explanation. Go ahead, Senator Stump.
Mr. Chairman, just to clarify, this would make it an annual grant versus the three-year rotating grant.
Mr. Chair and Senator, that is correct.
Good. Any other questions? All right. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Milt Schoen. I'm the Hennepin County Veterans Service Officer. I'm also the legislative chair for the Minnesota Association of County Veterans Service Officers. I'd like to tell you what we as County Veterans Service Officers do, what outcomes we achieve, and whether this bill, Senate File 536, will be worth the return on investment. County Veterans Service Officers are the point of contact in every county in the state to assist veterans receive the federal benefits and state benefits that they've earned. 90% of our federal claims that go in from Minnesota are originated by County Veterans Service Officers, and our veterans and surviving spouses receive $1.5 billion per year in VA compensation and pension. There's $1 billion in VA health care that benefits this state. When our Red Guard Red Bulls were deployed in 2006, at that time, 3 out of 10 returnees, Guard and Reserve members who returned from Iraq and Afghanistan, enrolled in VA health care. We as County Veteran Service Officers have gone to the site of their demobilization, and at this day, 98% of our Minnesota National Guard are enrolled in VA health care. They're receiving federal benefits. The federal government, the VA, is ensuring that veterans that have post-traumatic stress disorder and other conditions are being treated by the federal government, and there's no local share there. Our counties are dependent on property tax, and it runs between 97 and 100% of our budgets. So we would be leveraging a very small amount of money to be creative, to do the things that that John said that he would like to do in his county, and our president would like to do a transportation program to get people to the Twin Ports Clinic. It has the value of being able to have local areas use this money for their needs. It would be an incubator for change. It would help us with reintegration. It would help us with veterans courts, with homeless initiatives, with addressing post-traumatic stress disorder and making sure people get treatment for traumatic brain injury and for other things. So with that, we appreciate your looking at this bill. We appreciate Senator Chamberlain's bringing it forward, and we'd hope that you would support this measure and have it go forward. Thank you.
Questions for Mr. Schoen? Senator.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And I have some questions, and I won't directly ask Mr. Schoen, but I like the concept. I do like that it's 1 year instead of rotating 3 years, because I know the county service officers do a lot. I know in Hennepin County they really do a lot. I'm not asking Mr. Schoen this. I'm just pointing out that I do have some concerns. And one question would be, how is the Minnesota Association of County Veteran Services Officers grant going to be used? Because my one concern is, so Hennepin County, according to this paper, has about 64,470 vets. If I'm looking at this right, they'll get about $27,500, which, again, my math could be off, but it's about 50 cents. And then Traverse County has about 336 returning vets. They get $7,500, so it's about $22. So I'm a little concerned that that some of your larger counties will get hit hard. I don't want to take money away from the smaller counties who may have a smaller tax base, but I also want parity. So I'm a little concerned there, but I like the concept of this bill, so thank you for bringing it forward. And then if someone could just explain how the grant would work, that would be helpful.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dietzick, we received part of the way reintegration was funded was with a grant that allowed us to pay for the transportation of county veteran service officers down to Fort McCoy, down to Camp Shelby, and to various locations so that we can enroll veterans returning from Iraq and Afghanistan in VA health care. These veterans are eligible for 5 years of health care, not subject to the means test, so that's a very important thing that happens, and our association has used it for that. If the association were to get these funds, there are, you know, that may be one of the uses that the association would put it to. We have been in talks with others in the state to see if there's a way that we can set up a system so that we can get certified documents and have them in a database, so rather than having to call various counties to get documents, that once they're there, that we would be able to get them online. It would, and they're required for us in many cases to file for benefits. Speaking to just the dollar amount and the fact, you know, and the reality is in formulas, larger counties don't receive a share. I would much rather have the Department of Veterans Affairs directed to send a specific amount, since with the so-called competitive grants, there were 2 years I got $0 in Hennepin County, even though we sent five or six applications in during the last administration. There was 1 year where we're the only county veteran service office to put a grant in to address homeless issues in this state, and we didn't get it, and that was one of the major categories. So I think actually having some guideposts here would be helpful.
Any other questions? Senator Stumpf.
Mr. Chairman, I think that we have problems, different problems around the state, and obviously one that pops up or we hear about in my area is the distance between where the vets live and where they can get medical care. And it's not unusual at all that they have to travel several hundred miles either to come to the cities here or to go to Fargo or some, you know, wherever there's a veterans hospital. So, yeah, we've struggled and we've tried to encourage the better use of local health care facilities that our veterans could go to versus, you know, they have to be, I'm not sure of the whole process, but it's very difficult to get approval of a local hospital where a vet can go and get, you know, get the same, you know, care as in a veterans hospital. I think that someday it'll probably happen, but, you know, in greater Minnesota, the distance is a great problem.
Mr. Chair, Senator Stumpf.
Mr. Schoen.
These dollars could be used for transportation, and I know their efforts in northwestern Minnesota, I think it's V4V, has got some funding that they're trying to put together some additional transportation. The VA pays for health care at VA health care centers and community-based outpatient clinics, and that's the way it's set up. They're moving towards telemedicine and to other vehicles so they can deliver health care in a rural setting and provide more services, but it's a challenge, you know, in your part of the state. There are a lot of miles to get there, but, you know, these dollars would allow us, allow counties to work together to form a transportation compact to get people to the community-based outpatient clinic and to the medical center up there in Fargo.
Other questions? Any testimony out there? Okay. Senate File 536, Senator Chamberlain, we'll lay it over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill, and we thank you all for your testimony today.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So, members, on Thursday we'll be finishing up hearing the individual bills for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. It's my intention to roll our delete all amendment on Tuesday the 9th, close up the bill that evening. So we will have capital restoration, legacy funding, and the omnibus elections bill to hear after the 9th. Any questions? Good. Thanks for your attention today, and with that, he's adjourned.